out of bed. It's fine, it's fine. Daddy, are you okay?
I'm gray, honey, I'm gray, I'm gray.
I've got to tell her. Gwen half rose from her chair. I've at least got to warn her.
Sit down. Gwen, sit down.
Dan gave a self-conscious glance around.
Please, please, Gwen, can you please sit down?
She did so, wordlessly. Not so much obeying, he knew, as paralyzed, no longer trusting herself to act. He reached across the table and seized one of her hands.
Gwen, honey, you've got to promise me. You can't say anything to her or to anyone. Do you understand?
He pressed her hand tightly between his two.
Look, I never should have told you anything. It's my fault, okay? But I'm gonna convict this fuckhead. And it'll be way, way better for her, too, if Curtis goes to jail, right?
He scanned her expression to see how this was going down.
You don't want him to get off, do you?
No, she said tonelessly.
Okay, well, I don't need to tell you it would look really, really bad for me if my wife... If you were talking to Philippa about this, you'd make me look really bad.
He hurried on. If she said something to you, and you became a witness, I'd have to recuse myself from the case. Gwen didn't seem to find the possibility as much of a calamity as he did. Her gaze shifted minutely so that she was focusing on him instead of looking numbly ahead. But she said nothing.
You understand?
You'd be compromising my investigation, Gwen. In another minute, he would excuse himself and go make a call to Frank DiNapoli. He felt giddy with his newfound knowledge. At last he could see it all. Prostitution. Blackmail. At last it made perfect sense. The seemingly inexplicable elements of the case fitting neatly into place as they should have long ago. The possibility of the promotion to deputy chief of the unit asserted itself in his head again, coming back from where he had banished it a few months ago. He'd best Diane Costa after all. He glanced at Gwen. He'd get the promotion, and he'd make it up to her. He'd make it all up to her. There she sat, stricken, a few feet from him. He hated PDA, but he wanted to take her into his arms. It was touching in a way, that she had kept this childhood loyalty to Philippa. Nice when anyone had a childhood loyalty to anything these days. But Dan doubted Gwen's assessment of the relationship was all that astute. Women like Philippa lie. They didn't do friendship. Wrapping up his argument, he spoke in the low, gentle voice he used in court, when his case was so strong it was almost embarrassing, knowing that no point of hers could trump his. You have to promise me not to say anything and not to do anything that will interfere with the investigation. Your loyalty has to be to me, Gwen. It's our livelihood, remember? He added, in case she hadn't gotten the point. Yours and mine. And Mary's. For something to do with his hands, he poured her a glass of wine. Have a drink. You'll feel better. I'm going to make one quick call, and then we can look at the dessert menu, okay? The maitre d', Silvio, looked over at table 18 with surprise. The busboy was retreating quickly after having poured more water. The man, the big drinker, had excused himself, was stepping outside to make a call, the blackberry already pressed to his ear. Silvio looked harder, his surprise melting into an approving curiosity. The girl had put her head in her hands and was weeping openly. At last, from that lusterless tomboy, that Gwen who always made the reservation with her first name only, inelegant habit. A sign that she was a woman, after all. Chapter 17. They were waiting for him. He was leaving the building, and as soon as Ray held open the door for him,
"Good morning, Mr. Skinker."
He saw them standing in neutral loitering positions a little ways down the block. The thing was, in New York, no one loitered.
Morning, Ray.
They had been watching him all week, and they knew what time he left the apartment. Today was Friday. They wouldn't wait till Monday. He very much doubted they would wait till Monday. They had not been there when he took Lolo to the school bus. They knew his schedule, and he knew that they knew. He would have to pretend to be surprised when they approached him, goggle his eyes, or give a start. It wouldn't do to seem as if one had expected them. They wouldn't, Jed felt instinctively, like that. It was by chance he had noticed the Ford hatchback parked at the hydrant midweek.
He'd been thinking about his old dog who used to make right for that hydrant the minute she was out of the building. He had thought of that little black dog in the context of Roxy's puppies, six of whom had turned out pure black. The litter was living over at Billy Flood's cottage. It was May now, Ruth's birthday less than a month away. Squirmers. Only two of them looked German Shepherd at all. And then, from trying to guess what the father looked like, Jed had remembered his old, old dog, poor thing, ignominiously named Barky by himself and Sally. A funny-looking little black dog with a big head and a jaunty splash of white on his chest. They'd found him starving, collarless, in the woods some Danforth weekend, hidden him away in their bedroom for half a day, smuggled him into the car under blankets from which he promptly emerged, been told in outraged voices from the front seat that they couldn't keep him. "Your father will take it to the pound the moment we get home." And then woken to the surprise of their lives. Their mother had relented. Barky was theirs to keep. He'd always made right for that hydrant. Jed saw the silver hatchback again now, and realized he'd noticed it the night before as well. He knew at once they'd come for him. The emotion he felt was mild alarm at his dull-wittedness, that he'd had to sleep on the observation to understand it. He'd had a dinner that had gone late, and had come ducking home through a warm spring rain, 20 blocks, to find Mrs. Sampson sitting up. "She told me to leave when she went to bed, but I thought I'd stay." She shook her head at Jed for not carrying an umbrella. "Look at you. You're soaked, Mr. Skinker." "You've got an umbrella, haven't you, Mrs. Sampson?"
"I certainly do."
Mrs. Sampson looked scandalized.
"I leave my house prepared."
As the graying older woman gathered up her needlepoint and her purse, his eyes fell on a stack of yellow envelopes on the coffee table.
"She stayed up late working on these. Wants to get them out early this year."
When Jed failed to understand, Mrs. Sampson said,
"The invitations."
And when he still looked dim, she said,
"For Ruth's birthday."
"Already?
People need time to put it in their books."
"Of course."
"If men had to take care of the details, I don't know where we'd be, Mr. Skinker."
"Nor do I, Mrs. Sampson, nor do I." Jed accompanied her to the door. She had been their housekeeper when he was a boy, taken care of the three children as babies, and now babysat some nights or helped Philippa out.
"You've got your bank to run, I know, but it's the details we ladies have got to think about."
"So did she finish them?" he inquired.
"The invitations."
"Oh, she finished them." Mrs. Sampson sounded gratified.
"She's handing them out tomorrow at school. People have plenty of time to put it in their books."
Jed watched the woman wait for the elevator, unsnapping her long navy blue umbrella, and shaking it out with deft movements. And he thought of the latest board initiative at Skinker, whereby they were supposed to be focusing on management EQ. No longer would mere IQ do, it seemed. His head of HR was wont to ship everyone off willy-nilly to leadership seminars. But it occurred to Jed that she ought to have simply booked his staff a day under the tutelage of Beatrice Sampson, with whom Jed performed a nightly bit whose theme, doggedly upheld by Mrs. Sampson and himself both, was his long-suffering, irreproachable wife's having to put up with and somehow overcome his own wild ineptitude, his bumbling, his destruction of everything in his path. That was EQ. And the fact was, he was a bumbler. The two men had come in their silver Ford hatchback, parked in front of the hydrant, to explain how. People presumed, sometimes to his face, something altruistic on his part in the union. Not Mrs. Sampson. She had a much too subtle view of human relationships for an assumption like that. The condescension didn't rile him. He knew why he'd married Philippa, after all. But it was tedious. He'd married her for the same two reasons anyone, he assumed, married anyone else. Because he wanted to spend a lot of time with her, and because she would leave him alone. Perhaps he ought to have gone for one of those women who wore their children's names around their necks like dog tags. Then he could have been like the client strategy man in a meeting a while back who, learning that Philippa was pregnant, failing to realize it was with their third, had leaned in and told him in beatific tones,
"Jed, fatherhood will change your life."
He, for instance, presumed altruism. Curtis did. No. He presumed idiocy on Jed's part. He thought perhaps Jed had been duped, that Jed had not known about her past the way his wife had once earned her money. Curtis was the kind of man who bristled with excitement over the chance to cast himself as Iago, to tell. Jed had clearly put him in irons with his swift response to the initial call. "Please tell me what you want." The air gone out of his sails.
"I don't know if you know this, Mr. Skinker. It's rather delicate, you see. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but your wife..."
Men who thought to uphold some standard of purity were ashamed of themselves, Jed felt. He interrupted.
"I have no interest in hearing anything from you about my wife."
He was annoyed that his response sounded defensive when he wasn't. He was stating a fact, merely. Nor was he trying to protect Philippa with that phrase, "I have no interest," when he really meant something else. It truly was a lack of interest. He knew, after all. Knew it had lasted about 6 months, poor thing. After a few years, he had stopped trying to rearrange time and events in his head so that he got there sooner. Got her out of it before it even started. Instead, the law firm had come as her salvation. $25,000 a year net, plus overtime. Enough to survive. What sort of person would want more details? People were certainly turned on by funny things. Why was knowing everything about everyone else such a stimulus nowadays? Perhaps it was all some people had. All these obsessives who apparently were constantly Googling themselves. In a confused period of his life, when he had left Harvard but not Boston, he had lived with a girl in a Somerville walk-up. It was a point in his life when he was lost. He was resisting Hugh's pressure to come back to the city and take a job at the bank, but hadn't admitted to Hugh, or to himself for that matter, that what he wanted was to be in Danforth. That same year, Sally was hospitalized for depression, more incontrovertible evidence that the things that had made the Skinkers who they were, as the girlfriend relentlessly pointed out, were all wrong. When he woke up in the morning, his head ached with the knowledge. He consciously tried to be all of the things that people, peers, this girl, seemed to want him to be. He tried to be more open, to talk about the ways in which his childhood, meaning his mother, had scarred him. Also to start sentences with, "I feel," rather than, "The fact is, you've got to..." Years later, he ran into the girl crossing Grand Central, shortly after he'd married Phil. She knew all about it. Had Googled him, apparently. "Your wedding was in the paper, Jed. It's right there, didn't you know? Don't you Google yourself?" He must have looked at her blankly, for he recalled the girl thought it crazy, suspicious even, that he had never Googled himself. "Don't you want to know what you'll find?" No, he had no interest in what he would find. "My God," she'd cried, "I Google myself every day." Interest, the ultimate driver. The things that interested you, you pursued. Dogs, drainage. The things that didn't, you let go. Curtis said,
"Oh, you'll be interested in this, I think, Jed."
The predictable smarmy leap to his first name. And he, already weary of the game.
"Please, just tell me what you want from me."
A mistake on his part. You see, Mrs. Sampson, you have a point. No umbrella. No EQ. He should have realized that he took the fun out of it for Curtis at his own peril. A simple transaction wouldn't do. Curtis had anticipated something more nuanced.
"Calm down for a second, Jed. I'll get to that. You don't have to get all up in arms. I'm just reaching out here. That's all I'm trying to do. This is actually a favor to you."
Reaching out. And later, Jed predicted, glad his sense of humor wasn't abandoning him, Curtis would want to touch base. No doubt when it was over, and Jed was ruined, he'd want to circle back. In a reverent tone, he produced that most specious of corporate formulas. "For the safety of you and your family, please tell me what you want from me."
"Jesus, dude, LDL!
Weenie's code for "let's discuss this live." With distaste, Jed agreed. But when they did meet in person on a rainy night at a Midtown steakhouse, Curtis chose. He'd been working half in New York, half in London for a year while doing over an apartment, apparently. The man seemed to dither. He didn't seem to have followed the advice of the getting ahead in business tomes to nail down one's objective before the meeting. Was he there to blackmail Jed, or did he in fact want to make a social overture? Curtis seemed torn.
So, my wife knows your wife.
From the fellow's quick reveal, Jed guessed it was the truth, wondered briefly at the context.
From back in the day, I mean.
He was larger than Jed would have expected, and fleshy with the slack, defeated gestures of a much less wealthy man, and his hair was too good. The heavy-lidded ennui he talked in lifted occasionally in the course of the conversation, revealing laser-focused rage.
Hadn't seen her in years, but turned out they worked together.
An insinuating grin, which Jed stonewalled.
At the law firm, I'm talking, not, before.
Jed's expression didn't alter.
Please tell me what you want from me.
Curtis slapped his hand down on the table, making the flatware and glasses rattle.
Can't we just talk here? Can't we just have a conversation? Relax, Jed. Jesus Christ, have a glass of wine. You got to enjoy life, you know?
Curtis gestured to the bottle he had ordered.
This is good stuff.
He picked up his glass and held it up to his nose in one of those rituals people were going in for now.
Really good stuff. $150 a bottle, pre-markup. You can imagine what I'm shelling out for it here.
Uh-huh, Jed thought, with a modicum of relief. A man who goes through his days pricing things. He knew the type. It was the same type of person who liked to take you on a tour of his house when he had you over, opening bathroom doors so you could admire his toilets. Surely Curtis would get around to the price Jed had to pay before long. Surely they wouldn't have to belabor this.
Just name a number, for God's sake.
Yet a diffident, meandering spiel followed, during which Curtis did not once meet Jed's eyes, about how Curtis's wife had been lonely in London, and how in New York she hoped to be more socially active. Jed, the bumbler, still not getting what the man was after. It was only later that the idea dawned on him. So absurd he would have dismissed it. He suspected vanity on his own part, that Curtis had wanted to establish a kind of friendship with him. From some comments he'd made, Jed gathered belatedly that he had envisioned a future in which the Curtises and the Skinkers might socialize together, dining out here and there, the wives chatting about nursery school, perhaps, while Jed tipped Curtis on the deals Skinker was underwriting. Not blackmailee to blackmailer, but chum to chum. In the moment, though, he had sat perplexed and alarmed by the long digression. Curtis went on expansively about the square footage of the house they were buying in the Hamptons. Jed's mother snobbishly didn't recognize that entity, as if she were some grammar UN, referring instead to Southampton and East Hampton, where, growing up, she'd spent summers. And donations he had made unbidden to various schools, including St. Timothy's, I might add. He talked in a laid-back manner that in truth was supercilious and had a threat behind it, as if he still couldn't decide which tack to take, sycophancy or violence. Eventually, he popped the locks on an impressive-looking leather briefcase and withdrew a Times clipping that he pushed over the table toward Jed. When Jed did not reach for it, he pushed it closer.
Come on, man, have a look.
The picture was of Philippa and himself, a benefit his mother had made them go to in her stead. Landmarks, a pet charity of his father's, who was a good deal more troubled, tellingly in Jed's opinion, by the decay of old buildings than by that of humanity.
We saw this in London. My wife saw it.
A grin at Jed, which Jed couldn't return, not understanding it. She recognized your wife. She was so excited to see it. The food arrived, and contemplating the slab of tenderloin, Jed felt an oppressive, almost suffocating boredom set in. Dread enveloped him as they ate. The man's refusal to get to the point made Jed think he might never get home this evening. His idea of torture. Then panic seized him. He mustn't let Curtis know about the farm if he didn't already. He mustn't slip up and mention it. He and his family could leave New York. He had to get her out. He had known he had to get her out for years, because a time with her had never started in New York, and it never would. All the time he was to have, to spend with her. But if he could get her out to the country, the time would begin. He was sure of it. He'd long been planning an escape, grooming Chip Noyes, who'd been a protege of his father and who deserved to be CEO. He would do a much better job than Jed helming Skinker far into the new millennium. He'd gone so far as to draft a press release one night. Chip was for selling the building, had scouted office space elsewhere. Then last year, 2008, had happened. Worst luck. He'd had to put it off. Curtis mentioned nursery school again. Grade school.
You'd like a spot at St. Timothy's,
Jed guessed, failing to keep the impatience out of his voice. He was hoping to bring the man around to the point, help him get there so they could both call it a night. Jed, the bumbler. The man lost it. He had, as Sally, who was fond of the 80s slang of their adolescence, would have put it, a conniption fit. Palms smacked on the table. He rose and loomed over Jed, gripping his cutlery. Jed managed not to recoil physically.
Oh, that's among the things, plural, I would like, yes.
Abruptly, John Curtis sat back down and glanced out at the restaurant. He smoothed his luxuriant hair. After a minute, he picked up his fork and began eating, still half-facing out from the booth. Now Jed bored himself. He couldn't not notice that Curtis didn't hold his fork right. It dangled lazily from his hand as, like a spoiled child, he picked at his plate.
Your mother, Jed. Your mother is such a well-respected member of the community, Curtis told the room.
Soberly, Jed chewed a bite of steak.
Do you have something on my mother as well?
Curtis laughed at this absurdity.
On Winifred Skinker, beloved board member of Cleary Girls' School.
Tiresomely, he got the name wrong. There was no girls in it.
Jed, don't be ridiculous.
The insinuation that followed was not new to Jed's ears either. Curtis, in his defense, if not to his credit, was hardly the first to suggest to him that Jed's mother must have hated his marriage, must have tried to argue him out of it. He'd never heard the insinuation from a man, though. It was more a woman's tack, an ex-girlfriend here and there. The women thought they were paying tribute to Winnie with the notion, but in fact they were underestimating his mother. No one would have gotten her approval. She had known the night she met Philippa that her son would marry her. He'd taken the two women out to supper, at the Madison Avenue Italian preferred by Winnie, because they still used tablecloths and the wine glasses had stems. Philippa tactfully went to the bathroom between courses to give them a minute. His mother was trembling, blinking as she looked at him. He reached out and patted her blue-veined hand.
Must you?
A rhetorical question, so he didn't answer.
If you'd wanted. A different sort of life, Jeddy.
Her way of saying that he didn't have to keep the bank going. Not anymore. It had been nearly 5 years since Hugh died. They were over the hump. She'd let him off the hook now. He had sensed of late that she was over it.
In the '80s, and then when Dad died. Oh, I don't know, Jeddy. I didn't want it sold.
They were all getting eaten up. Alex Brown and Morgan Grenfell.
We were different. Skinker was different.
This was a tenet in the family doctrine, one he'd been raised on, but one that had proved inconvenient to uphold when he'd actually had to run the place. When, in order to retain Chip Noyes and two others of his ilk, he'd had to resort to a crude eat-what-you-kill arrangement. No subtlety in the compensation whatsoever. How different did Skinker Farr seem then? From time to time he'd envied the unborn heirs of W. Burgess Farr, who'd been saved the headaches.
It was important to me then, of course, but now I'd be
too late for that. With his free hand, he speared a fried artichoke.
You'll get to like her, Ma, he predicted, the longer you know her.
But he had underestimated Winifred, too. She snatched her hand back.
Get to like her, my boy. Will I?
If she wrung her hands after that, she wrung them privately, too proud to comment. No doubt she herself had faced down insinuations, probably many more than he, given how strongly people must have wanted to give her an opening. Old friends, colleagues on the Cleary board.
New daughter-in-law treating you right, Wynne?
As far as he knew, she'd never said a word against Philippa. As for Curtis, the things, plural, he demanded up front, were collateral obligations he had to keep to satisfy his wife before he got down to the money itself. Or so Jed assumed. St. Tim's for her daughter, followed by admission to Cleary. And while we're at it, another social nicety. A board membership for Minnie, as she was apparently called, on the Landmarks Protection Society. But as the dinner wore on, Jed began to see it wasn't that at all. Curtis, he saw, had a vision of how his life in New York should evolve. It was he who wanted to place his wife and stepdaughter into various roles in order to round out that picture, not the other way round. This Minnie, Jed perceived, might not care a whit about schools or boards. The insight came when he happened to make a comment that Curtis took up unexpectedly. Jed mentioned Curtis's boss. Coffee came, and with a sense of despair that Curtis still hadn't gotten to the point, still hadn't demanded the last and biggest of the things, plural, which Jed was sure would come. Jed observed, maybe digging a little bit himself. Your boss is on the Landmarks board, too, you know. Marty's been involved for a while. What was it he caught in Curtis's voice in that next moment? Pride? A sibling's rivalrous hate to discover that Jed had access to Martin Kerr? I found that out, his nostrils quivering. I found that out when we looked into it for Minnie. Jed waited for him to explain why he hadn't simply gone to Kerr for the favor. It certainly would have been simpler. But what Curtis said was, it'll be nice when my wife just turns up at a board meeting, won't it? Just turns up. And Jed grasped the man's true desire. He didn't want to use Kerr to get the board membership. He wanted to use the board to get to Kerr. Can you picture Marty's face when he realizes I never even asked him for an in? Not once, Curtis said. Kerr's irritable, unsavory mien, the permanent tan and capped white teeth, flashed into Jed's mind, but he said nothing. So, have you met him? Curtis asked defensively, as if prepared to be hurt by Jed's reply. Here and there. In Jed's opinion, Kerr was psychotic. $20 billion in the bank and still going into work in the morning. A persistent rumor that he encouraged his traders to take hormones to make them trade more aggressively. People think his reputation is exaggerated, but it's not, averred Curtis. He's utterly fucking brilliant. He seemed to weigh revealing something. Jed kept his eyes down and went on eating the steak. You know, he flew my wife and me down to Jupiter for the long weekend. On the jet, I'm talking. Not commercial. On the jet. When Jed didn't say anything, Curtis went on angrily as if he'd been contradicted. He came up from nothing. 10 kids in the family. Buttfuck northern Minnesota. Can you imagine? And now he's got this spread down there. Owns a fucking former plantation. Jed stayed quiet. He must not let on that he had been to the place. He'd been down there checking up on his mother's cousins, a favor to Winnie. Had run into Kerr in town and been obliged to go over with Philippa for a drink. Kerr had started to harass her 2 minutes after they walked in the door, flirting and putting his hands on her. And Jed had cut the evening short. He took me out golfing. Martinis at noon. Cracked crab. He never drinks any wine that's not a Grand Cru. And his wife? She couldn't be nicer. People say she's a snob. She couldn't be nicer. I fucking hate snobs. What's the fucking point? I'm as smart as you. I went to Yale. I graduated Phi Beta Kappa. Fuck you. You know what I'm saying? Joni swears. Curtis laughed fondly. Sounds like a truck driver. She cracks me up. She makes margaritas in the blender. They don't need to be snobs. Jed observed him. He'd watched Curtis be rude to the waiter. Bring it now. Got it? The way Martin Kerr was always short with his underlings. Kiss up, kick down, modeling himself on Kerr. Father figure he could appreciate, apparently. After specifying the temperature of Kerr's pool for Jed and enumerating Kerr's staff, Curtis seemed to lose track of the narrative. He seemed at a loss. The man's hand trembled as he stirred sugar cubes into his cup, laid the spoon in the saucer. Looking nervous, he took several quick sips. You know, Jed said stolidly, I could help you. Ha! A painful grin as he set the cup down. I hate to tell you, buddy, but that's why we're here. I mean, I could give you a job. It was what he had to offer, so he offered it. What? He flushed with anger. Why would I want to work for you? Jesus, don't flatter yourself, Jed. The longer Jed's offer hung in the air, the more indignant it seemed to make Curtis. You think I need your charity? Wow, that's some arrogance. I don't think you get it. I don't think you understand. So Jed, finishing his coffee, awaited a number. He couldn't predict how much Curtis would demand, but he had put some thought into how he could funnel the money to him. Bumbler. The junior guys who traded on inside information. They thought they were smart, smarter, smartest. Smart enough to get away with it. Get a number to count for your father-in-law. Buy 10 stocks, not just the one about to be acquired. The way they'd buy ice cream and chips with the condoms. But this guy, it dawned on Jed at last, had a motivation beyond arrogance, beyond greed. With a sinking feeling, Jed saw that it was no mere lump sum he was after. He wanted to impress the boss. To be given cracked crab at noon and not hit it out of the park. That was a shame John Curtis couldn't stomach. Swiftly, then, Curtis brought the conversation around to ATG, the microchip company Skinker was advising on its upcoming acquisition. "Good day, Mr. Skinker. Good day. It's a nice one," the doorman observed. He had just a second after Ray's parting words to size them up. The man who stepped forward first had salt-and-pepper hair and gaunt cheeks, pockmarked from adolescent acne. He looked tensed for action, as if he was ticking off the last fucking second he had to kill. Whereas the one who held back looked like a man you'd be glad to know. He was taller, with a hairline that was receding in no big hurry from his pudgy baby face. He looked affable, a guy to tell a joke, a family man. He played the side man, though. In reality, Jed sensed it once. He was the closer. Some non-threatening words of introduction Jed missed, and then... "Look, we know you've been in touch with John Curtis of the Invictus Fund." Odd that when he was confronted with a fact, it lacked drama. He had always known what he was doing, after all. There was no reveal. Still, it behooved him to listen politely. Offering any excuse was risible. Better just to listen, hear them out, be on his way. Ray was watching them intently from the door of the apartment building. He didn't like it. To reassure him, Jed put a hand up. "It's all right." The men followed his gaze, Salt and Pepper looking as if he wanted to punch someone. "We've got phone calls," he jumped in. "Subpoenaed records, a pattern of trades. We just want to talk to you." Salt and Pepper testily stated a few more facts. Babyface punctuated these with a summary. Jed's takeaway, as it were. "Look, Mr. Skinker, it's not you we want." "That's right. You we just want to talk to." The curious Latinate phrasing struck Jed's ear. "You we just want to talk to. John Curtis and Martin Kerr we'd like to lock up." When Jed said nothing, having nothing to say, Salt and Pepper went on. "You know, you guys met up at the Weiss house and talked about the nanotech acquisition, which Curtis later followed up about by phone. We got all that, Mr. Skinker." At this moment, Philippa was inside the apartment getting dressed to take Ruth and Sebastian to school. Jed acutely hoped that he would not still be here talking with these men when his family came out. Babyface again inserted the takeaway, a mild suggestion as if it had just occurred to him. "This may be your only chance to cooperate, Mr. Skinker." "We talked to Carol Ann Ritchick. We know she was putting through calls to you from Curtis." Jed started. Babyface, reassuring. "She was very upset, Mr. Skinker. She was in tears. She said you'd never get involved in something below board." Jed found his voice. "I'm glad to hear it was that upset her." "That's good," said Salt and Pepper, his sense of decency clearly offended by Jed's expressing relief. "I was worried Ms. Ritchick had gotten some bad news about her health." The day, 2 months ago in March, when Carol Ann had requested a morning off, citing, when she never had before, a doctor's appointment. He'd worried it was the cancer that had claimed her baby sister. There was something brittle in the way she stuck to her story. She'd be the type to hide an illness from him, knowing he'd involve himself, would want to pay. "A lovely woman. Clearly loves her boss. Very loyal. Same as your doorman, Ray, here. You got loyalty up and down the line. You want to come in and explain how you got involved in all this?" Babyface said, again in that neutral tone, the tone Ray himself used when observing the day's weather. "No honor among thieves, Mr. Skinker. You owe him nothing. You know that, right? Nothing." Well, but that wasn't it. That wasn't it, though it was a pretty good guess. Without thinking, he glanced up to the row of windows on the 8th floor of the pre-war building. Their apartment. His apartment his whole life, where Philippa was now getting the little ones ready for school. The man, in profiling him, had successfully plumbed his psyche. for it was part of it. To go tattling off to the feds, Curtis made me. It was true he couldn't picture it. In all of this, he'd never thought he'd be the tattler. Meeting the man's eyes, he said evenly, "I won't be coming in." He gave what he felt was a pause of acceptable length before stepping carefully around them and continuing up the block.
"We know about your wife."
Jed took a funny step, his shoe striking the sidewalk strangely. The two men caught up smoothly.
"We know you're protecting her. Shit's all gonna come out. Nothing you can do now to keep a lid on that."
The bumbler. He had betrayed her. Betrayed her with that glance up to the eighth floor.
"You know,"
he said skeptically, suggesting. What do you know? Perhaps it was all a bluff, a rumor they'd seized upon, fishing to see if he would bite.
"We know about her former,"
said the affable-looking man. And then he stopped, pressed his lips together, and looked courteously away.
"We know, Mr. Skinker."
Jed appreciated the circumspection, even if it was only a technique to get him to cooperate.
"How about you just tell us what you and John Curtis talked about for 10 minutes on that first phone call?"
the agent suggested, pleading a little. He looked baffled.
"What the hell did he say to get you to meet him in the first place? What exactly did he threaten you and your wife with?"
Salt and pepper, grimly.
"You're being blackmailed, Mr. Skinker. That's a crime on top of all the other crimes Curtis has committed, and for which he's going to go to jail."
Babyface, more conversational.
"It'll stay quieter if you come in now and shine the spotlight on Curtis. Focus everybody on John D. Curtis, not Jed Skinker. You don't want to be in the spotlight. You don't want your family, your wife and your kids in the spotlight, do you? That'd be exactly what you don't want, I would think, Mr. Skinker, a man like you."
He made a gesture encompassing the apartment building, the block.
"Private man, family man."
They had found their way halfway through his psyche. He would never cooperate to save himself. He would cooperate to save her. Yet. And this was a subtlety he wouldn't have risked on salt and pepper alone.
"Even though you know."
Jed paused. He didn't want to sound glib or ungrateful for the offer to come in and talk.
"You see, even though you know."
He repeated slowly, willing them to understand.
"I can't be the one to come in and tell you."
He could imagine the interview.
"So, when your wife was earning money, is... what sort of clientele? What acts were..."
"No. I never Google myself." "No." Something puzzled Jed. There was no reason not to ask.
"John D. Curtis,"
he said. "I wasn't aware there was a D."
"He added it," Babyface said, not missing a beat. "Wanted to give himself more of a Rockefeller ring."
In the moment of relative levity, he reached into his coat pocket. Jed flinched, expecting a subpoena, but the man held out a business card.
"When you decide it's in your interest to talk, Mr. Skinker, you'll be able to reach us here."
Jed took the card. He had been expecting to be served from the minute he noticed the two of them waiting on his block. Who, he wondered briefly, was letting him off the hook.
"We just wanted to hear your side of the story,"
Salt and Pepper threw out as Jed hesitated at the curb.
"You're not a bad guy. I can see that with my own eyes," Babyface said. "We just want the truth."
Strange that that obvious play for his cooperation should itself have the ring of truth. With a glance back at his building, Jed went into the street and hailed a taxi. He always got one right away at this hour. We hardly ever had real news. A real story to tell. Who does? Everything is known. Each day is uneventful unless it bears some minor disappointment, some minor joy. Even the little mishaps that once colored our hours. Waiting for someone at the wrong bar. Spending an extra hour at the gym after work because we had no plans. Only to arrive home to a message blinking on the machine about a party. Oh, my gosh. I was in my sweats microwaving dinner when I played your message, and I somehow managed to shower, put an outfit together, and make it down to the East Village in 35 minutes. Even those funny little ripples in our days as single girls had been flattened by our phones. Probably the most exciting moment in the past few years had been meeting, well, one another, as preschool parents. Now, though, our world had yielded an actual story that bore repeating. If only we could have gotten a word in. It was frustrating to us afterward that people who hadn't actually been there, and very few of us had actually been there, did not defer to us, but rather usurped control of the narrative. For months they went on with their factual errors and embellishments, both of which merely reflected their own biases and had little to do with the Skinkers. When the story told became so far removed from what had happened that day, and even began to be conflated with another story about a school admission scandal, we ceased talking about it. We felt as if we had undergone behavior modification. We, who liked nothing better than a good gossip, a coffee hour rehash of the latest embezzlement or divorce, had absolutely nothing left to say. For starters, the word sodomy was not used that morning. The conjecture, never confirmed, arose later. She, as she kept stating, simply wanted him to give Philippa the money. Skinker was not present, it's true, but he was not off being arrested, as some people claimed. In an unlucky coincidence, he had been approached that same morning by the FBI and had declined to reveal the very information that an hour later was broadcast so loudly on 63rd Street. But as Emily Lewin, J.D., grew tired of explaining, an approach is not the same thing as an arrest. Nor were we impressed by the commentary we heard many times in the aftermath of the event. Commentary that frequently ended, and in front of her children. We are the only ones entitled to shake our heads and mutter reprovingly about the fact that the whole thing happened in front of her children. Her younger children. Because we saw that they didn't understand what was going on. How could they have? They were small children. The boy 4, the girl turning 3 in a couple of weeks. Children pick up on themes, love, anger, more basically, warmth, cold. Tell yourself it's the details that scar children for life, and you avoid the inconvenient truth that it is in fact the ongoing themes. Control, disappointment, entitlement, narcissism, deprivation, frustration, sorrow. Or, as our children used to call out from the M5 as it passed the lions who guard the main branch of the New York Public Library, patience and fortitude. Patience and fortitude. That morning, her mother was handing out the invitations to the little girl's birthday party, not throwing the party that afternoon. The party occurred later on. Despite everything, she was determined to throw the little one's party. She was determined in the wake of the scene that took place outside St. Timothy's, the preschool. Not St. Timothy's, the church. Please don't try to inflate the symbolism. That late May, not June, morning, when the lovely weather had put us all in a good mood. The scene did not include the word sodomy or prostitute. All right, there might have been a fuck or two, but as an active verb, not as a swear, none of us who were there could be sure. It all happened so fast, in the 10 minutes before Mrs. Davidson called security. His wife did not get into a catfight with her. There was no hair pulling, there was no shin kicking, or, as Betsy Fleming started to say, when the recounting of the recounting of the recounting got so far removed from the truth, that we began meeting solely in order to refute the latest outrageous embellishments. There was no female mud wrestling on 63rd Street that morning. It is true that when he failed to produce the money, she yanked Minnie's Chanel bag from her arm and started to go through it, apparently looking for the wallet. It is true that it was Mrs. Curtis who paid her eventually. Minnie, as you may remember, liked to carry a lot of large denomination bills for the same reason most people who carry a lot of cash do. It gave her a feeling of plenty. It was not the last day of school. It was the last chapel, a day when parents were invited to attend along with their children. I'm mentioning this because if you think that school ended and the parties involved never saw one another again, you are wrong. It was the Upper East Side. We continued to see them. They continued to see one another, for a time anyway. Philippa, John Curtis, Minnie, Gwen, what's her name? The children. As for us, some people irritatingly assumed that we shunned Philippa after this. We didn't shun her. Why would we shun her? We had nothing against her. We liked her. Please, we would but ask, stop casting us as some reality television version of ourselves. We weren't the neurotically jealous type of Manhattan woman who signs up for every new diet to come down the pike. When we got ice cream for our kids, we often got cones for ourselves, with sprinkles. We participated in book groups that chose higher-brow novels than you might have thought. Yes, we read The Kite Runner, but we also read Rushdie. We read Murakami, We read Ian McEwan. The reason we didn't send our children to the little girl's birthday party that occurred a few weeks later was not that we didn't want to associate with the Skinkers. It was for the sake of our children that we reluctantly declined the invitation. Our children. Our children. The meaning of our lives and all that we had left. Was it fair to them to force them to be friends with a child of the most scandal-ridden family in New York after the Madoffs? Was it fair to them to blithely drop them off at an apartment now associated with insider trading and prostitution? Fair to our innocent children. To paraphrase Dr. Seuss, would you have dropped off yours? Despite all of this, when the day arrived and we did not go to the party, we were overtaken by unease. It was the day a mild paranoia started that we could never afterward wholly shake. We relaxed over the summer, maybe, but the feeling returned worse in the fall when we came back to the city and schools started up again. The cycle of drop-offs and pickups and schlepping to extracurricular activities. It had never occurred to us that they would leave, but leave they did, he one way, she another, and we were left behind. We were bereft. Without the Skinkers, our lives seemed like fading copies, Xeroxes of Xeroxes, the outlines growing fainter all the time. That fall, after Jed Skinker died and Philippa left town with the children, we understood that what we were doing here in Manhattan a decade into the new millennium was going through the motions. Though our lives had many joys and small satisfactions, we could never fully believe, once the Skinkers were gone, that they were our lives. Surely there must be something more, something to show us that we were not merely parasites, not merely good mimics. And although at first we scorned the Polo store that opened in the former Skinker Farr building on 54th, just west of 5th, pushing by with a scoff and a remark at the sides of our mouths, unless, of course, Emily Lewin was there, since her husband's family, the Simons, had added the building to their vast real estate portfolio. Ultimately, it was too conveniently located for us not to buy the occasional shirt or bathrobe or tie there, especially for those of us whose husbands worked nearby. They had the place all decked out with old pictures and Princeton oars and varsity pennants and side saddles, as they have at all of the Polo stores, so that it exuded old money. Well, Anna Grote went in one day to pick up some khakis for Guy, and hanging on the wall at the back of the men's section, what do you think she saw? A black and white photograph of Mrs. Hugh Skinker standing on the beach in East Hampton, holding the hand of her little son, Jed. Chapter 18. Toward the end of May, St. Timothy's School held a last chapel, which parents were invited to attend. Fathers came. The block saw more men on that morning than it saw all year. Loving their children, for this generation, wasn't enough. Financial security that in some cases would last generations wasn't enough. These men had to be hands-on fathers as well. Yet in the way they stood beside their wives, half-facing, half-ignoring one another, blackberries clutched in hands should conversation falter, eyes darting up, darting down to their devices. All of them urgently in demand at their places of work, apparently. The men seemed like unwieldy accoutrements, the wrong choice in handbags some of the women had made, and would now have to tote around all day. Philippa Lye, for once, had arrived early, so early that no one had actually seen her come. She was wearing a short-sleeved denim dress, grommeted all the way down the front. Her hair was tied back in a ponytail secured with an ancient-looking Hermes scarf. Perhaps the men's discomfiture, they checked their devices even more frequently when she began to drift among them, arose from the fact that though she was strikingly beautiful, she did not seem to have dressed with them in mind, as most women would have, but rather at the whim of some eccentric muse. They testily said to themselves that if they ever did stray, it would be with fun, busty Betsy Fleming, or angular, bitchy Heather Baird. Certainly not with her. In fact, Philippa had worn the dress because her daughter Ruth had asked her to, had stood in front of her mother's closet and said, "My favorite, please." But only Philippa and her children would have known that. Her little boy and little girl clutched at her legs as she walked from couple to couple handing out invitations, against explicit school policy, to the little girl's birthday party. She looked quite proud of herself, had quite the spring in her step as she shuffled through the bright yellow cards. "Now, let's see. Anne, where did we put yours? Mortification at Philippa's apparent ignorance of the rule made the women redden. Quickly, they stuffed the yellow envelopes into their bags, mumbling their thanks and inventing reasons for turning back at once to their husbands. Oh, Tommy, I forgot to tell you. But Philippa said distinctly to each one of them, Ruth and I really hope you'll come. But while the mothers were embarrassed and tried to downplay the invitation-giving for the sake of those who had not been asked, they stopped short of actually refusing the invitations. That never would have occurred to them. It would only have attracted more attention. They could always say no later on. Though the truth was, it was gratifying that the Skinkers were throwing a party at last. Philippa had always been the kind of mother whose children came to one's parties. Indeed, were the very last kids picked up from one's parties. But who never reciprocated with so much as a playdate. Suddenly, on a May Friday, there she was, handing out envelopes. It caused a very minor stir when Philippa stopped in front of Gwen Hogan and her daughter, and Mrs. Hogan refused to accept the invitation. Pretending to keep up conversations with her spouses, the mothers watched this intently, wondering whether Gwen Hogan was actually that much of a brown-noser, that she wouldn't bend a school rule to accept an invitation for that sweet, goofy daughter of hers. I can't, Phil. I can't accept it. She spoke with a gravity that one might have been forgiven for finding, in this setting, comic. What? Don't be silly. I can't, Phil. Gwen Hogan put her hands by her sides, curled them into fists, and refused to take the envelope in hand, as if she were being served a subpoena. If you knew, she said grimly, you wouldn't want me there. Philippa looked hard at her. I can't imagine. She scrutinized Mrs. Hogan, who just stared shamefacedly at the sidewalk, so that eventually Philippa knelt and handed the envelope to Gwen's daughter herself. You'll take it, won't you, Mary? Mom, an invitation, exclaimed the girl. And Gwen Hogan said dully, thank you. It was time for Mrs. Davidson and Ms. Babcock to come to the door to invite everyone in. The conversation among parents had happily crescendoed, spurred on by the expectation of another hour to come, in which the choices they had made in their lives would be validated again, in ways large and small. The Curtises were among the last to arrive, walking up the block from their idling car, Arabella between them with that sharp-eyed Weasley expression on her face. The Curtises had sat waiting in their car, rather than joining the expectant throng. It wasn't that they were above the self-congratulation that came with belonging to a little Upper East Side nursery school that was ferociously hard to get into, but they maintained a distance from it. They didn't love their school the way the rest of the parents did. Minnie gave the mothers the nervous-making sense that she was in this to win, not to have the opportunity to prove herself worthy of the honor, that St. Tim's was there to serve her purposes, and not the other way around. Was it true that, through connections, John Curtis had virtually forced Mrs. Davidson to take his stepdaughter, even though she had passed her fifth, if not her sixth, birthday? It couldn't be. The girl had told everyone she was six. And now here Arabella was, off to kindergarten at Cleary, and Minnie herself, apparently, halfway to a board position at the Landmarks Protection Society. All this registered with the parents, though not on the polite. Welcoming faces, they turned to John and Minnie. It was the first time most of the parents had seen the couple together. Curtis had made a late appearance at the Steins' party, of course. But they had turned out to be the type of couple that socializes independently, priding themselves on never giving each other so much as a nod, she courting Lally and her group, he deigning to speak with one or two of the bigger deal dads, including their host, Ron Stein, who today, noticing Curtis emerging from his car, had started up the block in the other direction and made a spurious work call, holding up an index finger when Lally hissed, "You promised, Ron!" The man, frankly, gave Ron the creeps. With uncharacteristic determination, Philippa pushed through to Minnie with a yellow envelope in hand, her last one. "Excuse me! Excuse me! Excuse me!" A strange punctuated exchange followed, muted, because at that moment the door did open, and Mrs. Davidson cried, "Welcome to you all." Philippa had handed the invitation to Minnie, and was now addressing Minnie's husband directly, as if she had independent business with him, a sufficient enough oddity to attract glances. "Please, come in," Mrs. Davidson exhorted them. In the pause before the parents started in, not a single one of them failed to hear the remark Philippa made.
I said, you owe me the money.
One or two of the parents rubbernecked. Most of them pretended not to have heard. But as the argument escalated, the procession toward the building was forced to halt. The Curtises had walked right into the front of the crowd when they arrived, so now the three adults and the three children had taken center stage, as it were, Arabella clinging tightly to her mother's hand, Ruth and Sebastian, ignored as usual, sitting themselves down on the lowest step of the school.
Look, I only want my money. You owe me the money. You at least owe me that.
A collective shiver went down the parents' spines. This was no bake sale or raffle ticket discrepancy. It was still Curtis, and only Curtis, she was addressing with barely a tremble in her voice. An affair gone bust. The assumption was transmitted through the crowd on some telepathic frequency.
Minnie said sharply,
What are you talking about, Phil?
I just want my money, repeated Philippa.
But she seemed to falter, as if the surrealness of the request had hit her. Things began to happen so rapidly then that no one afterward could be completely sure about the order.
Please come in,
Mrs. Davidson cried again. This time she gave a little peremptory clap of her hands.
Our program is about to start.
Phil, what the hell are you talking about?
Unhampered by doubt, Minnie simply tried to get to the bottom of it.
I want to get my money, that's all.
What money? What money are you talking about?
Curtis seemed to think that if he didn't acknowledge her, it would all go away. A look of disgust on his face, as if a crazy person had assaulted him on the subway. He tried to push by, but Mary Hogan's mother, who had appeared from nowhere, stepped into his path. She put a hand out to stop him, said coldly,
Give her the money.
Gwen? Gwen, what's going on?
Minnie said plaintively. She was so demure that day, dressed up in a pastel wool suit and yellow spiked pumps with flowers on the toe, the black handbag dangling incongruously from her shoulder.
Curtis kept her in clothes, all right.
Tight-fisted, the man was not, but for the one fatal exception.
Give her the money, John,
Gwen Hogan repeated.
The fuck?
His expression seeking to make a joke of it, Curtis cast an eye toward Mrs. Davidson, as if his record of donations to the annual fund, short but robust, ought to perhaps have spared him being publicly impugned in front of the school. Mrs. Davidson gaped at him.
You owe her the money. It's that simple.
That's right, said Philippa. It's simple.
Get out of my way. What the hell?
Excuse me.
You owe her the money.
Yes, you do. You do.
Gwen?
Now Gwen Hogan's husband came hurrying up the block, probably hoping to sneak in, stand at the back, and leave before the end of chapel but still get some kind of marital credit for making an appearance. He scooped up his child, who was standing watching, and cried,
Gwen!
When he saw whom his wife was addressing.
Get over here, Gwen! What are you doing? Get over here!
Gwen might have been a dog that had taken off after a squirrel.
Gwen!
Gwen Hogan had no reaction at all to hearing her name called. She didn't so much turn, though Mary Hogan said sternly,
Don't yell at Mommy!
Perhaps because of the tension in the air, Philippa's boy had started to whine and wail. Anna Groat knelt and tried to comfort him, but he actually whacked at her when she came close.
I want Mommy!
You want a good smack, Betsy Fleming muttered. Unfortunately, the remark rather hung in the air because by that point, everyone had gone still, even the children. As with any public scene, the crowd's first emotion had been surprise, yielding to a spark of glee that others were going down today and not oneself. Then a moment of fear that one would somehow still be implicated in the offense. And finally, irritation and boredom with the kind of people who made public scenes.
What the hell? Can someone...
John Curtis looked around for sympathy, the two crazy women so close he was hemmed in and unable to move. But Gwen Hogan had the calm, unbudgeable presence of the good parent, insistent, firm, unembarrassed by repetition.
You owe her the money,
shaking her head no at him.
She's not leaving till she gets the money, John.
Now Gwen had her hand on Philippa's arm, as if she weren't letting Philippa leave. The first look of doubt crossed Minnie's face.
Oh, my God!
She spat at her husband.
Are you having an affair? Are you having an affair with her?
Me? What the hell? Like any guilty man accused of the wrong thing, Curtis was incensed.
No, I'm not fucking having an affair. Please, give me some credit.
Minnie looked at Gwen.
Gwen?
She said tentatively. He owes her money, Minnie. Minnie's dark eyes flashed her uncertainty.
You know what?
You can all leave us alone, she announced, trying to block for her husband as they pressed forward.
We're going in.
Please, do come in,
Mrs. Davidson said valiantly. She had never looked